Thank you, Simon. Good morning, board members. Good morning, staff. Good morning to all of you who have dialed in to follow our proceedings. A new face, actually two new faces on our board starting this meeting. That shouldn't deter you. I hope you have fun in watching our proceedings, and we do have a very interesting agenda. We will start with classification and measurement, and I hand over to Laura and Rhiannon, please.
Thanks, Andreas, and good morning, everyone. Okay, so it was the end of last year that the board decided to start the post-implementation review of the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9. Since then, we've been performing lots of outreach to hear from stakeholders on their experience of using IFRS 9 so far, and also on their views on which topics the board should examine further in this classification and measurement part of the post-implementation review. We've now completed the outreach, and today we have three papers. The first, 3A, summarizes the feedback. The second, 3B, covers specific feedback on the most recurring topic during outreach, which is on financial assets with ESG-linked features. And that one is connected to the more general feedback on SPPI. And then the third paper, 3C, includes some preliminary staff analysis and asks the board to vote on the matters to examine further in phase two. And these will be the matters which we will ask questions on in a request for information. The discussion today will be used as input for preparing that request for information, and soon the board will review draft versions of that document ahead of the September meeting, where we plan to come back and ask the board to approve the publication and to set the comment period. One important thing to note is that as well as asking questions in the RFI on the matters agreed today, we also intend to include a more general question asking stakeholders if they have any other feedback within the context of the objective of the PIR. And so all of that feedback will be considered in phase two, not only the responses to our specific questions. In terms of how today's session will be structured, we're not planning to go through each of the three papers individually, but instead we plan to go through each of the six topic areas covered across the papers. So the staff will briefly introduce each of the six topics and then hand over to the board to discuss the feedback on that particular topic, which is in 3A and potentially 3B, and also the joining analysis, which is in 3C, and to vote on the relevant question, which is also in paper 3C. So with that, our first topic of the six topics is the business model assessment for financial assets. And the question for this section is question one, which is on page six of paper 3C. So the majority of the feedback on the business model assessment related to two areas. The first is the use of judgment, for example, in considering the significance and the frequency of sales when determining the business model. And the second was about reclassification of financial assets after initial recognition. And the staff are recommending that the board ask questions in the RFI to gather further information on those matters. So with that, I'll now hand over to the board to discuss the first of our topics, which is section A, business model, and question one.
Excellent. Thank you, Laura. And I open up for board members for comments, if any. Tadeo, please.
Thank you, Andrea, and thank you, Laura, for the paper. Very comprehensive paper, very good starting point for our for preparing the PIR. Just in relation to the comment on paragraph 14 that mentioned the problem of several cases of entities with business model assessment inconsistent with the way they manage the financial assets subsequently, I think that this is an area that you should explore to better understand, as I believe that this looks more like a matter of deal with by auditors and regulators than a standard setter. but I think it's worth looking at the problem and see whether we can help from the Sunday Center perspective. But that's why I think just we need to explore a bit more to try to understand whether this is related to the standard or application issue. In relation to paragraph 15, right after, we have provided a lot of educational materials on IFRS 9 and even made amendments to the standard to help stakeholders to deal with application issues related to the pandemic, but especially in relation to this feedback where some suggested mixed views on whether COVID-19 pandemic events are sufficient to trigger reclassification. I think this is a feedback that we could explore providing educational material or assessing whether a clarification this standard would bring more benefits than costs. I think that definitely is a matter to be included in the PIR to see which direction we could go. The only point is that if, and hopefully the pandemic is going to end soon, despite doesn't seem to be the case at this time. But if we can do something in terms of providing educational material in this regard, maybe it would be worth doing this faster than, for example, the PIR. That's something that we should think about it. And in relation, still within the business model topic, in relation to the comment in the end of paragraph 17, where some stakeholders suggested the board could permit a grace period, for example, 3 months, for an entity to determine the business model within which financial assets will be managed. Personally, technically, I do not think there is a strong argument, but from the operational and practical point of view, I can understand why they are asking for this. I remember, especially when applying IFRS 9 for the first time before I'm joined the board, I remember a case where management, after applying the classification, the interim period, and having a better picture of the whole portfolio, and considering that this picture, for many reasons, was a bit different from what they predict, they regret the classification for some of these financial assets in the following quarter. And then it's just a matter of 2 to 3 months, and they are already regretting what they have done. I think this is something we could explore, especially when we look at a portfolio of long-term financial assets that would be under less risk of accounting manipulation, especially if we compare with the situations, for example, described in paragraph 18, which I believe are genuine, but with a higher risk of leaving the door open for manipulation. These are my comments for the business model topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Let's hear from Bruce.
Thanks very much, Andreas, and thanks to the team for the paper. I guess my starting point is I'm really glad to hear that overall people do think the standard's working well. From my experience, I would agree with that. I think that IFRS 9 has achieved the objective, so it's good to see that that's some of the initial responses you've got. Just in terms of the two comments on that we're talking about, firstly, on the application of judgment, I always get concerned when one of the issues raised is the application of judgment. I mean, when I look at IFRS 9, to me, one of the greatest values that came out of the standard was the fact that people applied judgment and that we weren't giving you a bunch of rules that forced people into boxes, but that we actually had companies out there having to give thought to why they were holding assets, how they were doing it. So I'm not particularly perturbed by that comment. I guess what would be interesting is finding out if not if people are concerned about applying judgment, but whether it's not working. And I quite liked what we'd said in paragraph 14, where we said, you know, we note that applied consistently does not mean applied identically. I think that's probably in my mind where some people are maybe getting this wrong, saying, hang on, if I've got a certain asset and Andreas has got a certain asset, we potentially may classify these differently. Well, we hold them for different reasons, and I don't think that necessarily is a shortcoming in the standard. So I'm not too concerned about the applying judgment in terms of where that goes. I guess the one thing I was interested about with this would be when we start looking at getting some feedback. I guess one of the issues I would like to know is kind of maybe looking at companies outside of very large listeds. The reason I say that is a lot of the very large companies have generally got skills, they've got technical teams, they've got people who are experienced in terms of running that judgment. What you sometimes see is when you get outside of the very large companies, even some of the medium and smaller listeds, they don't necessarily have those skill sets. And I think what's been quite concerning to some of these people is that when they've been applying this judgment in terms of the business model, how they felt in terms of maybe not necessarily being as big. And I know a lot of the feedback we normally get on things like the FI standards are very much around the financial services, which is understandable because it has a big, very big impact on them. But I guess it'll be very interesting to see how it fits on the other side and even outside of those top tiers to see how they've applied this. Just going to the second point about the reclassifications, I think I'm probably close to where Tadera is. I mean, I think that, from experience, I've seen that when it comes to reclassifications, people did feel a bit like this was a very blunt instrument. In other words, you just couldn't reclassify. And I think a lot of people in practice, especially some of the audit firms I know, were really reading that as a very high hurdle in terms of reclassification. I think the challenge with that is that I do think there could potentially be situations where maybe we hadn't envisaged them, but something like the current pandemic has made us had to come and rethink things. So I guess what I quite liked about this was not necessarily coming out and saying, oh, we think it needs to be changed. I guess the question I would look at around that is, not is there a once-off situation that may need something different? Because when you have one-off, we deal with it like we did with leasing. It's more to me around, is there something in the standard that needs to look at, are there situations broader where we would need to set a principle around that? I wouldn't want us to get into a stage of just writing a whole lot of rules to fix specific circumstances because I really like the approach that's in the standard at the moment. So, yeah, those are my comments, just something to think about. Thanks.
Very good. Thanks, Bruce. Let's hear from Jin Zhao.
Thanks, Andreas. Also, I appreciate staff's the outreach activities have been done to identify those application issues in relation to classification and measurement of IFRS 9. I think all those information are very useful. I have one question and two comments. First, the question is about paragraph 17 of agenda paper A. The paragraph mentioned about loan syndications, and particularly mentioned that syndications, some loans company intend to sell in the future, but in the end, I don't know. What situation changed, but you said that under some circumstances, those entities cannot sell those assets previously they intend to sell. But you didn't provide detailed information. What kind of circumstances entity cannot sell? Is it resulting from external, for example, marketing changes, regulation changes, because of external reasons or because of internal management reasons, something like that? I would like to know in what kind of circumstances those companies cannot sell, provided if the market is still there. So this is, I think, I would like to know. Two comments about the paragraph agenda papers 3C. One is that I think for our request for information, one of our main objectives is to gather as much information as possible using this kind of consultation process. So in relation to the information we like to gather, first is about paragraph 13. Paragraph 13, we mentioned three areas we would like to gather further information. And paragraph 13C, mentioning that we would like to look at those areas, the practice are diverse, there are a lot of diversity in practice, and how pervasive those diversity is, and the effects of those diversities. I also like to see the reason behind of those diversities. So add one of the aspects, what's the reason why those diversity existing? And is it because of the standards itself, the requirements is unclear enough, or it's because of application or because of a lot of judgments needed or something like that? So I would like to see the reason, particularly I think it will be helpful for us to to decide what's the next step after we receive the feedback from stakeholders. Secondly, comments in relation to the reclassification. You have some kind of analysis you made in paragraph 18 and 19. And you said that some of the requests from reclassification of financial assets, maybe it's because of management intention change, not because of business model change. And I think one of the reasons because the former, you know, previous IAS 39 based on management intention to classify those financial assets, and now we've changed the model from management intention to business model. But what kind of information we would like to gather, you know, to address those concerns? And you end up that we like to gather information about the level at which the entity applied the business model assets. I think it's maybe not so enough to address those management intention concerns arising from the practice. I think I would like to know that what's the difficulty for those entities to distinguish management intention and the business model, you know, assessment. And how can the standard, from standard setting point, how can we help those entities to distinguish what kind of reclassification request actually arising from management intention, not from business model, you know, changes, something like that. I think, so this kind of information, this kind of question, I think we can ask, not only look at the level, because level, sometimes it's right, but it's not so specific to the question arising from management intention concerns. Yeah, so this is another comment I would like to add. Thank you.
Thank you, Jinzhou. Just to say, we have four more members who request the floor, and we do have five more questions to go through. So if that's okay with you, I will let the four ladies speak and then hand back to Laura to take us to the next set of questions. With that said, over to you, Sue.
Thanks, Andreas. Okay, a couple of specific comments and then a couple of general ones, if I may. So some of the comments in here from the people that we've spoken to so far, I think show a difference of sort of expectations in terms of what the standard was requiring than what I think the board intended. One of them, for example, is the fact that the assessment of business model is happening at different levels in entities, and that was by design. Because we wanted to give people the opportunity to choose the level they felt was most helpful for them to capture their overall business model in a more or less granular way. So while that's interesting, I think we need to be a little bit careful with some that have raised that as a concern to sort of understand why that should be a concern, given that was sort of by design. One thing I know has come up a lot with me when I talk to my banking buddies in business model assessments is the role of sales. I've heard anecdotally many, many times over the years that they feel they've done a very careful assessment of, you know, how budgets work, how people are paid and how the business is run. And then auditors and others come in and say, but you've got too many sales or too few sales cross move categories. I think we need to see what role sales is playing in the assessment and whether that's coming through clearly enough in terms of how dominant or otherwise it's meant to be. So that will be an area of interest. Now, general comments. What worried me the most when I read the feedback on business model versus I think what our intention was in 9 and also what we plan to do in the PIR in terms of expectations management is I felt there was quite a strong message coming through that many felt that reclassifications were too restrictive in IFRS 9. And as the staff rightly points out, that was very much by design. And that was because in 2008, when the board did the reclass amendments, investors were very confused by the changes caused by reclassifications. And so the board was very strict on that. If we look at when reclassifications have occurred and why, which is what's suggested in 3C, we're not really we're not going to be focusing on the thing that people are asking us about. They sort of are concerned about the reclasses they couldn't do in circumstances when they thought it was appropriate. So I think we're going to have to be quite careful with our messaging, because I think what the tone of our paper is implying is we think that reclasses probably should be relatively constrained to changes in business model. So we're not really, I think, seeking feedback on should there be more circumstances when reclasses occur. Rather, I think what we're trying to understand is, are there genuine circumstances when business models change and that's not been captured by IFRS 9? And so it's sort of a more nuanced analysis that I think we want. And that's going to be quite tricky, I think. And the example I think that to Dale or somebody else, maybe it was Bruce, mentioned was in the COVID situation, people feel that their business model has changed. And when we were working on IFRS 9 originally, it was hot on the heels of the financial crisis. And at that time, we were very careful to say, just because you can't sell stuff for a while because the environment is difficult doesn't mean you've changed your business model. If your plan is ultimately as soon as you can to go back to a different business model, it's just a temporary blip. And so I think we're going to have to be very careful picking through the information to find circumstances where there's actually what we would consider a change in business model, which is a more of a long-term thing, as opposed to sort of short-term changes in how particular assets get managed. And I think that's what the staff means. But I think those who have been talking to us, expressing all their frustrations about business model, might get a bit upset that we're not, they might feel we're not listening to them. So we're just going to have to be very careful with how we navigate this, I think.
Worthwhile reminder. Thank you, Sue. Anne, over to you.
Thanks, Andreas. I would like to support the staff's approach on this question of judgment, investigating judgment. And in paragraph 13, they talk about specific data that they would like to collect. And I just use this example with the judgment issue to illustrate some other points I want to make, in that the RFI questions, some of them can be answered with data, with empirical data that's available from a variety of sources. Others of them will elicit more opinion approach. And sometimes the opinion material is quite difficult to deal with and interpret. So I think it's helpful for the staff to know what sort of material they're seeking as they prepare the questions. Think in advance, what will be useful in response to the questions, because I think that will help you in framing the questions. So here, although the applying the judgment could be seen as something that will elicit people's opinions about having to use judgment, you've also suggested there's some specific data you will also collect to try and inform or illustrate what's been going on. So I would encourage you to go on with that type of approach. And so in setting the questions to decide, well, what data would be useful to answer the questions that we think we've got here, and thinking about the data and how that data might be collected, be it empirical data, and how in some cases it will be qualitative, and then how that qualitative data can be assessed. Because even with empirical, sometimes there's no benchmark. There's no benchmark. You don't know what is right or wrong in terms of, let's say, diversity or consistency, as you refer here. It can be valid that people are making different judgments. So I support the idea of collecting the data, and I suggest for all the questions of the RFI, so going in, as we continue this paper, that you think about what are the sort of data that you want and the nature of it, how it's going to fit together, and therefore inform the questions that are being asked. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. And I see Laura nodding, so that's appreciated. Mary and Rika, please. Mary.
Okay. I think mine gets to be quick because I can build on the very useful comments made by Jen Zhao and Stu about this business model and point. And Jen Zhao said it first in terms of identifying what is the difficulty for distinguishing the management intent from the business model fact. And then I think Sue's reminder about how difficult it's going to be to both acknowledge the feedback that we've received show that we've heard it, but not start kind of backsliding into the IS-39 management intent thinking, make it clear and be clear on our messaging about how IFRS-9 is deliberately different is going to be a challenge, but it's an important one that we have to match to avoid kind of a crash of expectations later on in the process. So just flagging that as a key challenge ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary. And finally, Rika, please.
Yeah, thank you. And I also agree with all other board members already mentioned. So I just want to make my comment very brief. And then also, I agree with what Jinjiao mentioned, and then just want to mention that if we want to understand the application challenges or status of diversity, as well as probably the compliance status of applying the standards. So I just wondering if the staff and we are reaching out to the stakeholders and ask the question about the frequency, it might be worth asking their initial expectation of the frequency as well as the probably what trigger the changes of their expectation at this moment or later on the time, and also ask the timing when they make a changes. It's like before they made an initial assessment or expectation or something trigger they make them change. So that's all from me. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. And with that, I'll hand back to Laura.
Thanks, Andreas. I'll actually hand over to Uni for this one. But just to say on a timing perspective, I was guessing, but I could be wrong, that the first three topics will likely take longer than the last three topics in terms of discussion. So timing-wise, we should be okay. But I'll hand over to Uni.
Thanks, Laura. The second topic of the session today is contractual cash flow characteristics assessment for financial assets, so-called SPPI assessment. Most feedback during outreach related to the SPPI assessment, and most of the feedback related to applying the requirement in the light of market developments, including new product features, and to the requirement for investments in contractually linked instruments. And the staff are recommending that the board ask questions in the RFI to gather further information on these matters. Given the significant amount of feedback we have received in relation to sustainability-linked financial asset, the staff prepared a separate paper, Agenda Paper 3B. And the purpose of that and the analysis in Agenda Paper 3B is to remind stakeholders the objective of the SPPI requirement in IFRS 9 and that an entity should look at requirement as a whole rather than applying selective paragraphs in isolation. We would also like to highlight there is no one-size-fits-all answer to the issue because the answer depends on the contractual terms of the financial assets in question. We think it is possible for some ESG-linked financial assets to have contractual cash flows that are SPPI, while others do not. We welcome any comments or questions and any additional views board members have on the subject which are relevant to this PIR for the purpose of developing RFI. I will now hand over to the board to discuss Section B, SPPI requirements, and Question 2 on page 9 of Agenda Paper 5C, including but not limited to the application to ESG-linked financial assets. Thank you.
Thanks, Uni. Before we open the floor on this one, Sue kindly reminded me that we should probably have a vote on question one because we were explicitly asked to say, do you agree with that? I thought that what I heard was a broad agreement, but just to be sure, can I please see a show of hands whether we do agree?
12.
Thank you, Nili. Get the statistics right. All right. So I open it up for any comments. And I see Sue and Bertrand and Mary and Tadeo and probably everyone else. Okay, Sue.
Thanks, Andreas. You should be pleased. We're so excited. So solely payments of principal and interest. Okay, so firstly, on contractually linked, I think that's going to be a really important one to ask questions on. Over the years, people have, you know, tried to pin me down offline in terms of what my views were on the scoping. And I think there's some very, you know, real questions about how the scoping is best applied. And I think on that, it will be really helpful. The more specific the examples are that people can raise with us, the better, because that's when the, you know, you really get into the things people need to think through. And I think it's an area where actually we might be able to help by doing some clarifications. On solely payments of principal and interest more generally, and sort of linking in also with the helpful analysis that you guys did on the sustainability linked things in paper 3B, I think this is a really important area to sort of understand you know, whether there's enough guidance in IFRS 9, firstly, for people to know what to do. Do they understand what to do? And then secondly, what the outcomes are and whether it results in the most useful information. Now, you know, I think that IFRS 9, you know, in my unbiased opinion, is very neat in terms of the way that it tries to identify things that are capable and appropriately measured at amortized cost by trying to work out what sorts of cash flows can that very blunt instrument of amortized cost mechanics deal with. And that's a nice model, better than the embedded derivative stuff we had before, which was very, you know, it's a bag of rules, I've heard it described as in the past. So I think what we want to try to do, if at all possible, is really understand that if people think that we're ending up with instruments which could be appropriately measured and provide useful information with amortized cost mechanics, what features are we missing from this assessment of solely payments of principal and interest that is not capturing those features that they feel can be appropriately measured using amortized cost mechanics? And I'm being very careful with my language, because I think nine, it's not trying to say some things are good, some things are bad, we want you to invest in this, we don't want you to invest in that. It's not trying to make sort of moral judgments. It's trying to work out what mechanism provides the most useful information to investors. And we worked on credit and time value of money, and that was quite neat. But it's possible that we're missing something. And so we should think about that. And I think we should think about it in two ways. One is, could the amortized cost mechanics work to capture these other features? And how are people using the amortized cost mechanics? When are they updating estimates and adjusting carrying amounts? I think we need to understand that as part of the process. And that's something that was just discussed by the Interpretations Committee last month. And on the flip side, if these things do move to fair value measurement, does that in fact appropriately capture information as well? Is it possible to measure some of these features using fair value measurement in a way that people can understand and can actually operationalize? And I think we need to be quite balanced in those things, but we really need to try and encourage people to sort of work with us constructively to think about what's useful information, what's operational, and to think about it more holistically rather than, you know, investments which are good investments for society must get amortized cost measurement. We need to sort of try and avoid that and get them back to sort of IFRS 9 thinking, but while listening to the genuine questions that are coming up.
Thank you, Sue. And now over to Bertrand. First appearance. Be nice with us.
Thank you, Andreas. I will, surely. When I read agenda paper 3B, and notably paragraph 31, when I read the sentence in the stabs, it is inappropriate to conclude a financial asset as contractual cash flows that are SPPI only because it has features of a lending arrangement that is common or widespread. I said, yeah, that's a fair statement. But what if all borrowings now or in a very soon future could have features of a lending arrangement as the one analyzed in agenda paper 3B. And it echoed to the discussions we had at the June Interpretations Committee. I was still an Interpretations Committee member at the time, on the TLTRO3 borrowings, and notably on the interaction with the outcome to the question we were asked to provide, and the interest rate. So the question was really focusing at the end of the discussions on what is exactly the interest rate. So couldn't we add a specific question? Because I think the two are linked. The two questions on these two issues are quite linked. The question is really, should we consider interest rates and the link to amortized costs as a kind of absolute, or is it relative? And if it's relative, it's relative to what? Probably to what the state of the market is. But I think it would be worthwhile to analyze that. Otherwise, I fear we might receive a pile of questions at the Interference Committee each time there is a new borrowing with new features that emerge in the market.
Thank you, Bertrand. Mary, please.
Just a couple of thoughts in this area. One is, I think, a messaging point. And I think this relates to Sue's comment, which is SPPI is a test, not because we want it to be strict or because there's a price that, you know, is exacted for amortized costs, but rather because of the identification of the circumstances in which amortized cost provides useful information. And the characteristics of the SPPI test reflect our assessment of those situations. And I think we just have to keep reinforcing that message because, you know, as you said in paper 3B, there is some sense that as long as it's a typical feature, it must be part of basic lending, and that isn't the case. We have to go back to the usefulness of the information that would result and whether amortized cost is useful for, you know, that feature. So I think the staff is aware of this. It may sound repetitive and dull in the context of an RFI, but I think we really have to keep making that point. And the other thing is, in paper 3B, having walked through, and I think you reminded people of the need to roll up your sleeves and do the basic analysis of different features of loans that may have, you know, kind of ESG features, and how there is no one size fits all answer. I think, though, in terms of messaging, of signaling, you know, you appropriately then went on to say, okay, if you conclude, you know, that's for some of these amortized costs may be appropriate, how do you do EIR? I, you know, when I came to that, I think we have to make sure that it's phrased in the context of for those that kind of make it through the filter for which there is a conclusion that that's appropriate, because it did kind of come across to me as, okay, we've done the analysis, but now let's just assume that amortized cost works, and then how do you do EIR? I think it really is about emphasizing that that's for the subset that passes through the filter, and it's passing through the filter not because we're being mean and parsimonious with how SPPI gets applied, but because that test is the proxy for when the information will be useful. So I'll get off my soapbox and hand over to the next person. Thank you.
Thank you. Passing on to Tadeo.
Thank you, Andreas. First of all, I support the staff recommendation to gather information on the application of the SPPI requirements for this matter on sustainability. But despite all these comments are related to sustainability, there might be other situations that could impact the interest rate and are similar to what we are discussing. Incentives to perform certain metrics and not necessarily on sustainability without supposedly a variation in the cash flow for the SPPI assessment purpose. And again, I support the staff recommendation to gather further information on the application of the SPPI requirement for this matter. But I think that we could incorporate in the questions on the RFI whether the stakeholders are aware of other similar situations. Just thinking about what you many times referred to in the papers, that is to keep the principle-based approach in IFRS 9. And then I'm wondering whether this more holistic approach to assess all similar situations, not only those related to sustainability, makes more sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Tadeo. Jinja.
Thank you, Andreas. I also support staff's proposal to ask question about application of SPI test to those new product features, and also support ask question about investments in contractually linked instrument. In relation to those new product features, I think based on our analysis, I think compared to IFRS 9 years ago when we developed that standard, and now I think the main change is about those ESG, you know, features has been included in some of the products. So I appreciate your analysis in the agenda paper 3B. In relation to what kind of question we are going to ask, what kind of information we would like to gather through the question we ask. I think first, from my point of view, is that we should ask one question related to what kind of ESG, you know, linked features currently in place. And for example, it's related to emission reduction. It's related to, you know, I remember some of products, actually some of features related to how many women's, you know, employees you're employed. And then banks will give you some kind of 10 BP or 20 BP to compensate the interest rate you need to pay. So to ask this kind of question, the details of those features and how those features being considered when the banks or other financial institutions determine the interest rate. So the relationship between ESG related features and the relation with the interest rate granted from those banks or other financial institutions. I think this kind of information would be useful. Second, about the information relating to the investment in constructually linked to the instrument, I agree that there is a diversity in price in practice. Once again, about the information, what kind of information we are going to gather. Currently, we propose that we would like to gather some kind of examples, which, you know, diversity in practice may exist, and to understand the effects of those diversity. I also would like to say the reason why those, you know, diversity exist, as I said before, and it will help us to find a solution. Because once we identify the reason, and then we can find a solution. Not only to identify diversity, I think it's not enough. So this is the second comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Jinzhao. And I might take the opportunity to just step in here, if that's okay. I would like to come back to a comment that Sue has made at the beginning, and saying we need to be very careful, especially with the first of the two questions being asked, that this doesn't become an inadvertent moral question of are you eligible for amortized cost treatment, yes or no. I think balancing two aspects of the mechanics on the one hand side, so what do you do if we say you have to measure at you may measure at amortized cost, and that means establishing an effective interest rate that actually lets you do all the mechanics, and balancing that off with decision usefulness of the information that is resulting from that measurement or the concurrent measurement with for fair value is key to me. So when I read the question in here, applying the assessment in light of market developments, I think it may be a bit too broad a question to ask, because we might just be flooded with all the ESG instruments and similar instruments being now new kids on the block. And I would try to avoid us getting down the question, is this part of basic lending? Is this now a plain vanilla instrument? But linking it back more to the mechanics of saying, okay, yes, we said basic lending is what we had in mind, but we had it in mind because amortized cost is actually doable in these instances. If you do have ESG factors that cannot really be baked into an interest rate, so you can't apply the effective interest rate mechanism. It may still be regarded basic lending, but simply the mechanics won't work. So I think we want to flesh out more that balance between, if there were new developments, how can we build them into the model that actually you can do the EIR requirements and the EIR calculations, and balance that off with, is the resulting information decision useful for those that read the financial statements? Thank you. With that, I hand over to Bruce.
Thanks, Andreas. Just a couple of comments on this. Firstly, I mean, clearly we need to look at this. I mean, the whole concept of SPPR is fundamental to the application of IFRS 9, so we need to look at it. I think when I look at the issues that were raised, I mean, once again, great to hear that upfront, genuinely, people thought this was working. And I think we need to stick to that kind of key principle of has the overall objective of why we wrote this and how it's got to be applied working. I think a lot of it comes back to maybe what's also been mentioned just recently by Andreas as well. I mean, we need to ask ourselves to start off with, is SPPI achieving what we wanted to achieve and what the board first has set out to get then? Is it working in practice? If I look at the two areas where people raise things, I mean, I think on the contractually linked instruments, I mean, from what I could see from the feedback, it wasn't necessarily that people said it didn't work. The comment was around things like, well, do we think maybe that there's no clear definitions in some of the terms? Are we starting to scope in things we didn't intend? So those are the kind of questions I think we should be asking. Do we think that that those things that they've raised in that in 3A it was, do we think that those are giving unintended consequences? So I'm happy with that one. On the second one, I mean, I think once again, when we get into this whole issue, we've got to be careful, as Andreas just mentioned now, we don't want to get that shopping list of instruments where suddenly everybody thinks this is a great opportunity just to get everything we don't understand fixed. Once again, start off with that question, are these SPPI? And I was going to make the same comment around the mechanics. We've got to ask ourselves, can the mechanics work when we start tying all these things in? Because I think when you start trying to adjust all these and you start to work on the math and how it's going to work, that's going to become a bit tricky. The other thing I was going to say, I think we do need to explore was, we did mention around the minimus and the non-genuine effect of some of these. I think that's something I'd be interested in finding out, because I do get the feeling that some of the features we're seeing are, I don't want to necessarily say are not, are disingenuous, because I don't think that's fair to some of the market participants, but we're seeing that these are not having a major impact on what people are paying at the moment. We're seeing that I think, and also let's face it, it is a buzzword at the moment, and a lot of people are wanting to make sure they're being seen to be investing in these type of instruments or holding these type of instruments or issuing them, in fact. So I think we've just got to be conscious that we need to make sure that at the end of the day, these are actually going to have an impact. Personally, I think these going forward could have a bigger impact. I do think this is something that companies are investing in. And I think, like many of the things we look at, it may not be as big now. And look at the size of the market, clearly it's not as big as other instruments are. But I think if we consider that the BIR can take us a year, 2 years, 3 years to get something completed, I think in 2 or 3 years, you could potentially see this being a very, very big and growing market. So from our point of view, I think it is something we need to be asking questions around. Yeah, that was it. Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce. Let's hear from Tom.
So I thought I'd take the opportunity to be the first board member to agree with Bertrand, so I'm going to do that, although I agree with a lot of other things that have been said. And I tend to not want to ever diminish a principle and a standard, and I agree with what the staff said in paragraph 36 in the B paper, that staff don't imply that ESG-linked adjustments may be SPPI because they're small or because they're common. But I think what Bertrand said, though, is a call, and I think other people have raised it, Tadeo and others, that if these things become really common, there's bound to be pressure build, because the big danger is if you have a very small thing that trips you into fair value, then through that very small opening, all the volatility will flow. And then you'll get pressure back, because there'll be a question as in substance and usefulness, this is much closer to being amortized cost. And so I'm not sure I really was impressed with the arguments about how we ask this kind of a question, but we do need to get a sense of what might be on the horizon and not so that we're not simply reacting to a deluge of worry because new instruments are popping up all over the place that that really threaten the basic principle. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom. I wouldn't say that what you've observed is in disagreement to anything that we have heard. I think what I sense is that we want to be cautious about how we phrase that first part of that second question. And I think there was a unanimous sense around the table saying, how do we balance the new developments with our logic, our key logic that's currently sitting in IFRS 9, and are the two potentially at odds? Sue, please.
Yeah, I just wanted to add a quick point on the amortized cost mechanics that I think is going to be important to bring out in the work that we do. And so I don't want it to be missed. And I think it's also relevant to some of the points that Tom and others are raising. I think we have to be careful not to get sucked into arguments about everybody's putting these features in these loans, therefore they're becoming normal, therefore they necessarily need to be an amortized cost. I think we need to be careful about that. But more particularly, I think we have to be really careful to make sure that we understand what information would be produced if particular features are included in solely payments of principal and interest, and what that means in terms of the mechanics of amortized cost. And more specifically, to make the point of what I'm trying to say, there's sort of two things that go into the amortized cost mechanics, just to state the obvious. One is working out what your effective interest rate is up front, you know, and how you do that. But the other really important thing is what then happens if there's changes in estimation. So the tricky thing with these, some of these instruments, as I understand them, is you can have changes in cash flows, which could be small or they could be really significant. There's potential for both that get triggered in certain circumstances. And the question for me is to understand, you know, I think in those circumstances, people should be re-estimating their cash flows, adjusting carrying amounts, and the effect goes into profit or loss. That's what I think should be happening. But some of the feedback I've been hearing anecdotally, I don't think that is necessarily happening. And if amortized cost accounting is being done in a way that's more cash accounting, so that if there's a change in estimation, so it becomes far more likely that, you know, there's going to be quite a significant change in cash flows, and that's not being captured at all in the measurement until it actually eventuates, I think we need to be careful about what information investors are getting and that they don't get blindsided by sudden changes in cash flows. So I really want to make sure that as part of the work that we do in the solely payments of principal and interest work, we're also making sure we understand how amortized cost is actually being used in practice in terms of how people are getting the mechanics to work. So we really understand what investors will see and what they won't see and when they'll get the information. I'm worried it's going to be too late. And so I think we just need to be really careful with that aspect of it as well.
Thank you, Sue. And finally, Erika.
Yeah, thank you. I think, I agree with other board member already mentioned, especially about the last comment before me. I mean, I agree with the staff recommendation about the inclusion of a question relating ESG-related features. And then also, I think it's quite important for us to understand what types of features and then also what type of the challenges they are facing in the practice in connection with those ESG-related features and instruments. And then what I really want to understand is in the future, we need to discuss what we can do as future actions after this consultation. So I really want to understand how those challenges in accounting as well as probably communication with investors in the disclosure or other part of the financial statement are different from the similar difficulties they are facing when applying IFRS 9 to other non-ESG related financial instruments. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. So what I sensed from board members who have spoken, I think we are generally in agreement with asking the questions, but I would remind us and probably the staff in thinking carefully about the first question and not so much putting the emphasis of the on the market developments only, but also linking that up to decision usefulness and the mechanics and what we are trying to achieve with that. I think that will be important. That's not dugging away and saying if something becomes really common, we should just be agnostic to that and say our model is good enough. We don't need reality. We shouldn't be really locking ourselves into that discussion either. But I think we probably want to see a bit of fine-tuning to that wording. With that said, can I see a show of hands whether we agree with question two?
Zach, I don't see you on camera. Otherwise, I see, okay, 11, one absent.
Okay, thank you. And with that, I suppose I hand back to Laura. Is that true?
Yes, thank you. Okay then. So our third topic is the option for equity investments for presenting fair value changes in OCI. And the question for this one is question three, and that's on page 10 of paper 3C. So this actually, it wasn't one of the most recurring topics in feedback across our outreach. So it didn't come up as much as SPPI or business model or even modifications. But we do know that it was a topic that was contentious during the development of IFRS 9. And also we know that some stakeholders do feel strongly that it should be considered in the PIR. And for that reason, the staff are recommending the board ask questions on this matter in the PIR, and that those questions focus on gathering information about the prevalence of the use of the option and also on the effects of the requirements. So for example, how, if at all, have the requirements affected companies' investment decisions? So with that, I will hand over to the board to discuss section C, which is equity investment.
Thank you, Laura. And I pass on to Anne.
Thank you. I agree with these questions being raised, even in the light of your comments, Laura, that it wasn't coming up a lot in the first phase. And I agree because it's been topical, and we know that there are certain jurisdictions for which this is very topical. When I read the questions in question three, they read like the questions we would want an academic team to go out and find the answers for. And I'm not sure how the general population who will respond to the RFI will actually come at these questions. That's not to say I don't think they should be framed like this, because this is the information we want to know. But the first one, A, should be able to be answered by somebody doing academic work and investigating. That is true of B as well. It's more difficult to do B. And so it may be on both of them, the type of feedback that comes through the RFI, people's comments and their qualitative assessment will actually be useful and helpful. We probably need to know who's making the comments. So if you were framing 3A and 3B as academic questions, you would also have a question that said something about the characteristics of the entity taking the option. You'd want to know that, and the academic evidence will find that. So as the RFI information comes in, I'm sure you'll keep a track of who said what when, because we already expect that some of these responses are jurisdiction specific. They're influenced by people's current or prior practice. So just keep track of where the feedback's coming from, because I think that will be part of your analysis. By all means, phrase the questions like this for question three. I do support that, but I think they're phrased in a way that's very good for academic evidence to go and find the data and give it to us. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Let's hear from Nick.
Thanks, Andreas. I want to speak to the concern about the treatment of long-term equity investments under IFRS 9. And I think this stems from a perception that users focus on performance as depicted in the P&L statement to gauge the performance of such investments. And I'd actually describe that as a misperception. I think if you are there, you're invested in an entity which is making such long-term investments. Actually, you're looking at the total return over time on that portfolio. You're not looking at what's happening at the P&L from period to period. So what I'd encourage staff to do against that background is when looking at this particular issue, we need to ensure that we are speaking to those users who are making investment decisions rather than intermediaries in that space. Often those intermediaries will use the P&L as shorthand to describe performance. But actually, let's speak to those who are making capital allocation decisions, whether or not to invest in such entities that carry out long-term equity investments. Thank you.
Thanks, Nick. Bertrand, please.
Thank you, Andreas. I concur with Nick's comments, and I would add, effectively, I would like to stress on this subject probably the importance of the usefulness of information. Not just for users, but also the meaning for preparers, appreciating the operating and financial performance of their businesses on one hand, and of their investments as a whole, and their own capital allocation. So I think it's I would have distinguished in the question the usefulness of information as a criterion per se. Otherwise, I agree with the questions asked there by the staff.
Thank you, Bertrand. Over to you, Bruce.
Thanks, Andreas. Quick comments. I think most have been covered off. Just obviously, I think we do need to ask this question. I mean, this was one of the bigger changes that came out of the IFRS 9, and I think we need to ask people how they're feeling about the OCI provisions we've put in. Just one comment I was going to make on the prevalence. I mean, I agree with what Nick was saying on obviously what the users and investment decisions. I guess the other side I would also look at is I think it'll be also very interesting to hear from preparers in terms of what management are doing and how that's impacting on what they're doing. Because I know for some of them the recycling was quite a big factor in terms of investment decisions that they made. And I think it'll just be interesting to see kind of on both sides. A, is it impacting on management's investment decision? And then separately, of course, how's that impacting on the usefulness? So I would try to distinguish between those two.
Very good. Thank you. Zach, please.
Thank you. Along the lines of what Nick said, I think an important note, and I'm sure this is implicit in the staff's question, is I'd like to make sure we don't just focus on situations where the option is applied, but also think about situations where it's not and what the effect is on users and investors, because I think the fact is, in most cases, preparers haven't taken advantage of the option or haven't chosen to use the option. And if we hear from investors and users that that's a great thing, that's important information that should convey into this question. And likewise, if they say, well, no, we'd prefer to have it, that's important information as well. I suspect it's the former, which is why I want to highlight that we need to not just narrowly focus on situations where the option has been taken, but keep it the broader universe and see how users are applying the information provided.
Thanks, Zach. Jinchao, please.
Thank you. I also agree with Nick and also Dak said that and also Bruce also mentioned, I think the usefulness of the information is the first priority. We would like to seek the feedback from stakeholders. And that usefulness is focused on investors' usefulness. And currently, if we look at question B, we only focus on the effect on entities' investment decision. Actually, we would like to say the information, how could it affect investors' investment decision. So that is one dimension. Second is obviously we also would like to gather the information about the effect of option, but also not only limited to option, as Zach said that, and those equity investments, accounting policy will affect on entities' investment decision. But I think investment decision internally is not enough. Also, we would like to gather further information how those accounting treatment will affect entities' internal, performance evaluation, particularly relating to those investment decision. I think that is another dimension we can look at. So there are two dimensions for externally investors, you know, decision information needs. Another is internally how those companies will evaluate the performance of those investment decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, Jinjiao. And finally, Andreas. My question is on prevalence, on the word prevalence. I was wondering whether we mean prevalence or whether we really mean circumstances. Because the prevalence is just a fact. It's a data point because companies needed to make a decision and they are bound by that decision. My question would be whether it would not be interesting to see in what circumstances entities had actually used that option and in which other circumstances they have not, to Zach's point, really. Because when this was developed, I think the board had in mind really a quote-unquote only strategic investments. It seems to me that from the evidence that I'm aware of, that this has been applied much more broadly than only to strategic investments. And the questions, I think, is not really picking that one up if we say we concentrate on prevalence, which seems to be reading to me like quantity. What's the percentage that entities have actually made use of the OCI option? But we can't really get into the reasoning why or why not they have chosen this. And I will be interested in seeing this being fleshed out. Any further comments by board members? And see anybody who wish to speak. So can we then take a vote on question three? Are board members generally appreciative of this, taking into account the commentaries round?
Twelve on question three. And then Andreas, if I could go back to question two.
Yes,
it actually turns out that Zach was present, but I understand the video had just blipped out for a second. So question two is also 12.
So unanimous. Good job, yes. Team. All right. Thank you, Nili. I pass back then to Laura for question four.
Thank you. Okay. So topic four is on financial liabilities, and the question is question four, which is on page 11 of 3C. So we didn't receive too much feedback in this area, but some stakeholders did comment that this requirement or the own credit requirement was a key improvement introduced by IFRS 9. Despite the fact we didn't receive that much feedback, the staff are still recommending that the board ask a question in the RFI on this topic. And we're recommending that because I think, as the board noted back when you were setting the objectives for the PIR, while it's important for us to look at the specific topics of interest, it is also important for the PIR to take a holistic view of the standard as a whole and to cover off all pieces of the puzzle rather than an incomplete picture. So that's why we're suggesting asking questions in this area as well. So with that, I will hand back to the board to discuss section D, which is financial liabilities.
Okay, excellent. See Mary wishing to speak.
Yeah, it's just to ask Laura to comment a bit more. In paragraph 39, just right before question four, you say gathering further information on the application. Sorry, I should have started by saying I agree that even though we didn't hear that much in phase one, we should have a question about financial liabilities. So basically supportive of the staff recommendation. But focusing on paragraph 39, where you say gather further information, I wondered if you could just amplify a little bit about what that further information might be and how we'd used it. Because that's kind of presumed rather than explicit when you come to question four. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So I think the majority of what we heard was just that people are happy with this requirement and it did the job it was intended to do. So we just wanted to check that that is the sort of prevalent view of stakeholders. But then on top of that, in the feedback paper, we did say, you know, there were some people that said potentially that own credit requirement could be applied to a wider scope. And there were a few that said they'd had difficulties assessing, separating changes due to own credit. So there were a few bits of feedback there, and we just wanted to go out to the wider stakeholder group to see if that feedback was consistent with what we've heard already.
Okay. Mary, you want to come back or are you satisfied with that? Okay, I see you're nodding. Excellent. Sue, then.
Thanks, Andres. You know, for me, this is marginal whether it's worth including in the RFI, but for completeness, I can see why we would include it. I was interested in some of the feedback where some were sort of frustrated that it was only available where the fair value option had been applied and questioned whether it should be available more widely. That was a big, you know, consideration of the board back when the original scope was set. And my recollection is that we did that because we were concerned that it's actually not that straightforward to separate out the own credit piece. And so we wanted to sort of make sure that it wasn't everybody that got sucked into that. It might just be worth making it clear in the RFI why that decision was made so that we don't sort of rehash old arguments. At least people will then have be reminded to think about that context. If they still feel strongly, obviously they can still make the point, but it might just be useful to point that out.
Okay, thank you. Jin Zhao.
Thank you, Andres. Just a comment on what Mary said, that what kind of further information we would like to gather in terms of application of the own, credit requirements. I think one of the areas from my point of view is that because as we mentioned in the paper, one of the challenging areas is how to determine the fair value changes related to own credit risk, So I think maybe we can particularly mention how those companies are determining that value changes related to their own credit risk, what kind of approach they adopted. And I think also, I'm not sure, actually disclosing this kind of information actually can provide useful information to the users. But I think getting this kind of information may be useful from my point of view. Yeah.
Thank you, Jin Zhao. Anybody else? Then I may just have one comment, and that's more related to a question, implicit question of complexity of the model. So when IFRS 9 was developed, I think respondents said very clearly IAS 39 is not broken as regards the liability side of the balance sheet. So therefore, no big need to actually change it. Absent the change that we did on the credit risk portion, I think there are a number of implicit decisions that have been taken then. So for instance, retaining the requirement to bifurcate embedded derivatives was something that we had heard people bringing up for financial assets as well, where we rather classify the entire compound instrument rather than bifurcating the bits and pieces and classifying those. So I was just wondering whether that would be an opportunity for us to just seek explicit views of people where they still believe that the liability side should retain their old model and should not comply with the new classification requirements that we have set in place for financial assets. Because that is then asking the question of, is this good or bad or unavoidable complexity? If that's a concern that's being flagged by some. With that, question four for board members, can I see a show of hands whether we agree for asking that question? Okay, so I set the bar high. 13 minutes left for two questions and I expect board members to vote 12-0. Over to you, Laura.
Okay, so our next topic is modifications to contractual cash flows. So that's question five, and that's on page 13. So we did actually receive quite a lot of feedback in this area, and that feedback was generally mixed. There were two camps. Some stakeholders suggested that additional application guidance is needed or that drafting changes are needed. Whilst others said that the requirements had been working well for a long time, and those others didn't see this as an area to examine further. The majority of the feedback we did have from those looking for additional guidance related to defining what is a modification and also to determining when a modification results in derecognition. and the staff are recommending that the board ask questions in the RFI on these matters. So I'll now hand over to discuss modifications.
Super, thank you. Any comments, questions? Sue has a comment.
Thanks, Andreas. I think this is an important area for us to get some more colour on. You know, we know that in the amendments that we did for IBOR that this came up. So I think this is an important area. There was a bit of a sort of emphasis in here on identifying whether or not there's diversity in application. For me, I would like to sort of understand more broadly what's going on, because if everybody's doing something we don't like, I'm not going to be any more happy. So I guess getting a better colour around what's being considered to actually be within the scope of modifications is something that's interesting to me, and I think we should dig into that. And even if everybody's doing the same thing, let's make sure we know what it is and agree that that's appropriate.
Okay, fair comment. Anybody else? So to me, that seemed to be a very fair question. Can I see whether board members agree on question 5 to add a question on modification? Thank you. And finally, Laura, transition.
Okay, yeah. So transition is our last topic, and that's question 6, which is on the last page of the paper. Again, this is one of the areas we didn't receive much feedback on, but we do think that gathering feedback about transition will provide useful input for developing transition requirements when it comes to future standard setting projects. And also, you know, we note that while this might not have been at the top of people's priority lists during their first outreach meetings with us, the format of the request for information and the time that stakeholders will have to respond may result in us gathering more feedback in the next stage than we did during outreach. Therefore, the staff are recommending that the board ask questions in the RFI on the transition requirements. So I'll hand over to you to discuss this last topic.
Thank you. Anne, please. Oh, sorry, Mary was first and then Anne. Sorry.
Okay. Mine is a more general comment prompted by the comment about transition. I'm fine with asking the question as suggested, but it did just remind me now that one of the purposes of a PIR is, you know, after focusing on the specific standard or standards in question, to also step back and reflect on our standard setting process more generally and whether there are any lessons for the standard setting process that we should apply elsewhere. Given that IFRS 9 was a project that we approached in phases and had multiple phases and effective dates, I guess I want to ask the staff if they'd thought about asking a more general question around phases and structuring of the project, and if there's anything that stakeholders say we should take away, either in terms of doing or not doing again in the future. And I apologize because it just suddenly struck me when you were teeing up the transition question. I hadn't thought to flag this in advance for you, so I'm sorry if I've caught you on the hop.
No, I think that's a worthwhile comment, and I suggest that probably we also be more specific in saying transition requirements as regards classification and measurement in IFRS 9 in order not to ask the implicit question, how about impairment, how about hedge accounting, right? So we want to focus that on beyond classification and measurement, I think. Okay, I see Mary nodding. Anne, please.
Thanks, Andreas. So I think this question will bring out a discussion about the disclosures that were provided. And I seem to recall in the early time of adoption of IFRS 9, there was a lot of discussion, and perhaps we heard feedback of disquiet amongst investors, not getting the information they need. And we know a big change in a standard breaks the time series of the data. So I do think it's valid asking this, even though there's not been a lot of comments in phase 1, because I think it's really important to our process. And as Mary said, part of the PIR is giving us feedback on our process and looking ahead into future standard setting. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. Bruce, then.
Thanks. Just a very quick comment. Just when I looked at the questions we were asking in para 48, I like the way we'd phased it in 48A when we talk about the challenges entities faced in that. I didn't really feel that came across in the questions we were answering in question six, where we're saying the effects of the transition relief, for example. So I was just going to say something from what we're asking people to actually comment on. I quite like what we put in 48A. Just
okay, think about substituting that, right? Alika, please.
Yeah, thank you. I think I agree with the other board member mentioned about this is a great opportunity for us to improve the future standard setting process, especially about this question is a transition. So I think it might be really helpful to understand the perspective from the users of the financial statement, especially about how the relief affected their own analysis, the transition, as well as how useful and how they use the extensive disclosure to mitigate such shortage of the information caused by the relief. Thank you.
Thank you, Rika. Sue, please.
Thank you. I was surprised with the lack of feedback we got on this, because if I had a pound for every time I've had somebody complain to me about what a pain the transition to classification and measurement was and how it had no effect on classification, I'd be a very rich woman. But clearly the pain has passed. I think it's really good for us to get some feedback from investors in terms of whether this transition disclosures worked well for them, in terms of, rather than requiring the restatement of comparators, so building on what Rika just said. I think the specific thing I'd be interested in getting thoughts from, and maybe prompting people to think about this for us by sort of giving it as an example, would be useful, because otherwise it's a bit abstract, is, you know, we asked everybody to go back and look at all of their contractual cash flows and business and business model. You could simplify it, but in essence, you could have to look at a lot of contractual terms to work out your classification. And that's why people complained when I spoke to them, because that was a really huge exercise for some people. And then if you ended up with not much change in classification, there was a lot of work for the benefits that they saw. So I guess what I would be interested in understanding is whether people have suggestions for us on how we could make use of grandfathering in those sorts of circumstances in a way that would be appropriate and sort of proportionate. So I think there is definitely a risk it's not going to translate to other standard setting scenarios. But for example, if we had said, if you've got an embedded derivative that's separable, then you need to look at the SPPI characteristics. But if you don't, then just assume that your SPPI for existing assets or something like that, then maybe that would have been a lighter touch for transition without much difference in outcomes. So do people have sort of observations based on what they looked at for how we might have made it easier for them to get from A to B without changing too much what the outcomes were? Because I think that's the sort of thing that might be helpful for us to think about to ease transition for people in the future.
Agree with that. Bertrand, please.
Thank you, Andreas. I quite like the question that is asked, and agree with most members that pointed out the fact that we need to ask questions in this regard. There are still companies transitioning to IFRS currently, even in geographical zones where IFRSs are mandatory or have been mandatory for quite a long time. So I think it's an important question to ask, and because there have been recent prepares transitioning overall to IFRSs.
Thank you, Bertrand. Mary, please.
Just going back on Sue's comment and thinking about it for a minute, and I guess I want to challenge her just on one point about whether the specific question she was suggesting about could we have done transition a bit differently in a way that got us largely to the same place with lower cost. I think that's a good challenge for us to ask ourselves, but I'm wondering whether asking it will produce answers that are so specific to the IFRS 9 classification and measurement that it won't help us think more broadly in future circumstances. So while I think it's the right kind of question to ask, that was certainly, you know, one big piece of feedback about the cost to get to not much change. I think I'd want to push people for more higher level answers. But as Sue pointed out, thinking about the impact on the usefulness of the information to users and giving them a good basis for going forward, not just how could you have made it simpler to declare that you were on IFRS 9, but I'd want to stay away from asking the question in a way that would get us a lot of very IFRS 9 classification and measurement specific responses that we could then couldn't generalize that easily.
So do I take it that you were happy with the way how question 6B was phrased, where there was just a general statement of reducing cost for preparers and keeping the balance with providing decision useful information to users, without going into any specificity that is related to IFRS 9 classification and measurement? Have I heard you right, or am I misinterpreting you?
I think so, and it's not a major disagreement. It's more a drafting consideration.
Yeah, I mean, what we could do, obviously, is when we draft that question, that is that we ask respondents to provide examples where they believe that this equation has fallen on the battery side, because that would then inform us exactly of those points where we, in the future, might think differently. Sue, you had a comment.
Yeah, I don't... That's why I had my caution of it might be too IFRS 9 specific. What I am keen to do, though, is to at least give an example or something to make it a bit more real for people. Because I think this bland question, people are not really going to know what it is we're trying to get at. And we need to sort of, you know, we need to prompt them with a sort of thing that would be helpful for us to understand. So not wedded to my example, but I think it would be good to have something specific to use as an idea to sort of get them on our wavelength.
So provide context so that people know what we are expecting of them. I think that's fine. All right. Okay. With that, I sense that people were in agreement that it would be useful to ask that question about transition. I think the one change that I have heard, and I haven't heard anybody objecting to that, is the suggestion that Bruce made. Is I be a bit more explicit in A as to what you're asking. So taking probably the context in paragraph 48A before and bring that to the fore. I see Laura nodding and I see my timer prompting. Can I see a show of hands, please, then, whether we agree?
Can I just confirm something, Andreas, if that's all right?
Sure.
Just in relation to that specific drafting comment that Bruce raised, which I agree with, I'm presuming that the questions that we actually end up with in the RFI are not going to be sort of as, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, sort of bland and general as the questions that we have asked us to vote on. They're going to be worked up more based on the more granular assessment. This was just to facilitate the general agreement so that you can go away and then craft the words. Is that fair?
Yes, that's exactly correct. That. We didn't, you know, we didn't want this paper to be the RFI itself. We just wanted it to have the board discussion. And I think it's the feedback from this discussion we'll go away with to have those more specific points. And you'll get to see the draft. So we'll look forward to your comments on that.
Good to know that we get to see the draft. Excellent. Thank you. Rihanna, anything you want to add to Laura's comments?
No, that was fine. Thanks.
Okay, super. So congratulations to the team. You actually made it happen in 90 minutes. And congratulations to our board members who have voted unanimously on all of the questions. With that, if there are no further questions or remarks, I would close that topic and open the next session on maintenance in consistent application.